This is a CBC podcast.
Hi there, it's Pia, and every Wednesday, we're bringing you a bonus podcast, one handpicked story from the week's round of the Sunday magazine that we think is definitely worth hearing or hearing again. Of course, you can hear all of our stories on the full podcast that we put out on Sunday and on the CBC Listen app. All right, here's this week's highlight. Now, the name Christine Blasey Ford may conjure an image for you of a woman wearing a navy blue suit with her right hand raised standing before the United States Senate Judiciary Committee surrounded by a sea of cameras.
I am here today not because I want to be. I am terrified. I am here because I believe it is my civic duty to tell you what happened to me while Brett Kavanaugh and I were in high school.
In 2018, the psychology professor gave testimony saying she was sexually assaulted by Brett Kavanaugh when they were both teenagers. That testimony was part of the hearings to confirm Kavanaugh as a justice on the U.S. Supreme Court, where he now sits. He vehemently denied the allegations and accused Christine Blasey Ford of, quote, totally and permanently destroying his family and his reputation. For Christine Blasey Ford, her words gripped the world and changed her life forever. Many heralded her as a symbol of the Me Too movement. Others questioned her motivations and her credibility. Some sent her death threats. Now she is sharing her experience of her story in a memoir. It is called One Way Back. It explores the events leading up to her famous testimony and how it has shaped her life ever since. Christine Blasey Ford joins me in this Canadian exclusive interview. Christine Blasey Ford, good morning.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
You know, I just described how the world came to know you. You, of course, are much more than that image of you testifying in 2018 that has come to define you in the public eye. But I want to take a step back with you. Before 2018, how would you describe the woman known as Chrissy Blasey?
Well, I had a pretty good life. I was a university professor working hard from August till June and then spending 9 weeks every summer on the beach and in the ocean. Serious at work and more fun outside of work.
Sounds good. sounds good to me. And you said you spent a lot of time in the water in the summers because you are a surfer, and you write about sort of the analogies between surfing and your experience in your book. So here you are, the professor, the mother, the surfer, a person who was also carrying something else with her for many years, and it came to the surface in 2018. You were 52 years old at the time. You describe being on the beach. You're hanging out with a couple of your friends. Your kids are playing in the water. And almost nonchalantly, you say to your friends that you had been attacked by a man who was being considered, or at least sort of thrown around his name at the time, to sit on the U.S. Supreme Court. I know there was a lot of steps beyond that, but can you take us through the steps from making that disclosure to taking it beyond telling your close friends and your husband?
So in that initial week when his name was being tossed around, there were a list of candidates who all looked equally qualified and had equal viewpoints. And I had very, what I thought, important information about one of the candidates. And I felt that it was my civic duty to share that information as quickly as possible. I grew up in Washington, D.C., and this sense of patriotism from spending, you know, childhood and middle school field trips to the Supreme Court and to Congress and visiting those places many times, taking my own children to see those places. And I just very much revered those institutions and think of the Supreme Court as where we send the best of the best.
And so you tell your friends and you say to yourself, I've got a responsibility, a civic duty, as you say, to take this forward. What's the next decision you make?
The next decision was to call my U.S. representative, and before this election was made. So I called her office And then I also put in an anonymous tip to one of our major news outlets.
So you shared your story with the Washington Post. I'm not throwing that out there. You name them in your book, your Congresswoman, Anna Eshoo. And you eventually also write a letter to then-Senator Dianne Feinstein. In reaching out to those various people and publication in one instance, what did you hope might come from that?
Well, I hoped that they would take the information and share it and decide whether they deemed it important to consider for this very important position. And I felt a sense of urgency about it. I'm not sure that they felt the same sense of urgency that I felt.
Yeah, how did they respond?
Well, they advised me to write the letter and then advised me to hire attorneys, which then I did. And I did that, and then I underwent a polygraph test. I didn't really understand why I needed lawyers. I hadn't done anything wrong, and I simply wanted to relay information that I thought was useful to try to help the people who were making the decision.
And as you're sort of getting these opinions and advice from various people, are you at any point saying to yourself, you know what, forget it, this ain't worth it, I'll just go on with my life?
Well, I had no idea I was going to end up one day on television, so I thought this was all going to play out privately and that maybe there would be a private meeting with senators or officials who were considering the vote on him. And so I was going forward thinking that it was going to be a private situation, not a public situation. It wasn't terrifying until I knew that it was going to be a public situation. So.
Yeah, and as things progress, you described that your lawyers advised you not to go public and make your identity more known, saying, as you write, quote, "We can't let you stand in front of an oncoming train." What did you think was behind that warning? Like, what did you think when you heard those words might happen if you did come forward?
I took that to mean that in some ways the outcome was predestined and that there was nothing that I could do about it, and that the information would have no bearing on how he would be considered. It was a little bit disappointing because I, of course, thought the information was really important, but I also didn't know that much about the rest of his life, and I only knew my experience with him, and I thought that that was sufficient to at least consider.
You did eventually make your identity known. You came forward after your name had been leaked to the media. And then in time, the Senate Judiciary Committee holds these additional public hearings to discuss your allegations. So there you are, like on September 27th, 2018, the day the world met you, the day you stood in committee to give your testimony. There were millions and millions of people who tuned into this televised event in your country and around the world. And I remember clearly when you began to speak, you could hear the emotion in your voice. As you sort of sit here, you know, 6 years later, how do you remember that day?
I remember walking down the hallway and knowing there was no turning back. And I was just trying to make it to the chair. And once I sat in the chair, I was looking up at the seal of the United States. And I was quite in awe and also quite overwhelmed by the setting. But I had to just take it one question at a time, and I didn't have the opportunity to be too scared. I had to just manage what was directly in front of me. I just, I guess, leaned on my sense of patriotism, my sense of doing the right thing the way I'd been raised, and that I was telling the truth, and I had to detach from the outcome because that was just too stressful to think about. So that was really helpful to just detach from the outcome and not be invested too much in that part.
If you're just joining us on this Sunday morning, I'm Pia Chattopadhyay, and I'm speaking with Christine Blasey Ford about her new memoir. It is called One Way Back. Your allegations and testimony led people to paint you in very different lights. Many have celebrated and continue to celebrate you as a feminist icon. Others tried and continue to try to poke holes in your credibility. Some have accused you of having ulterior political motivations. How did that frenzy about you affect your life in the weeks and months following your testimony?
It was actually years that it affected me. It was very difficult for me to grapple with both of those things. And very scary. My family, we were living away from home. It wasn't safe to be at home. So we were gone for 3.5 months and living with security detail. We were protected by them. And then the psychological impact of it was quite difficult. But on the other hand, I had this outpouring of support from all 50 states and 42 countries, handwritten letters that were just so powerful and heartwarming and heartbreaking, and boxes of letters from Canada. So I really appreciate everyone, those of you who wrote a letter and all the people who thought about writing a letter. The people from Canada were incredibly supportive and buoyed me through that very difficult period.
We're going to get back to those letters and talk a little bit more about the impact they've had on you. But I want to take us back to that moment, because we're in 2018. This is your testimony, you coming forward. It's all happening on the backdrop of the Me Too movement, that period that illustrated the extent of sexual violence happening to women around the world. And whether you wanted to or not, you became a sort of symbol of this moment. And you describe and you write about worrying about not being a quote unquote perfect women's rights advocate. Tell me more about that concern and how this sort of complicated the whole situation for you.
Well, at the time when I was testifying, I wasn't really thinking about the Me Too movement. It wasn't like in my conscious mind that I was part of that movement until afterwards. Then I started to connect strongly with that community. I was thinking I was more of just a person who was a letter of non-recommendation for the candidate. I did worry about my imperfections, and I describe them all in the book, and the things that I had done in my life and how that might be twisted and used against me, and that I've seen it play out with other assault survivors and other people who step forward and testify for other causes, that there's this immediate reaction called DARVO, where the accuser is discredited and they reverse the victim and the offender, and it becomes, I ruined his life, so I become the offender and he becomes the victim. And it's just a playbook that's used so often that it's very predictable.
Did you think at the time, like, I know probably how this is going to go?
Yes, I had this thought that, well, people would say to me, they're going to ruin your life. So it wasn't like I wasn't warned. But that's a really abstract thing to say to people. And that's part of the reason I wrote the book, is to make it a little more concrete for anybody else that might be out there in this situation and wondering, what does that really mean? Because, you know, they're not going to kill you, but they're going to do things that are going to make your life really difficult. And I underestimated that greatly. I thought it meant that people back in Washington, D.C. would call me the B word or something, and I wouldn't really maybe even know about it, but that I would lose some friends, you know, certainly any friends that overlapped with his friend group. So I just really underestimated what that would look like.
And as much as you feel comfortable telling me, what did that look like, the pushback and the hate?
Well, there was quite a bit of smear media and smear books accusing me of things, from being a drug dealer to other types of business fraud and just things I could never have imagined ahead of time. It was quite upsetting, I have to say. The one thing I did that I'm glad that I did was that before I came forward, I checked with my employers and asked them if they thought this would have any bearing on my employment. And they said not at all. And I feel very privileged and grateful that I'm in the position to speak. And it almost made it, that was almost a motivation and made it even more of a duty that I should speak, given that not everyone can do that.
You wrote that you think that most people believed what you described happened to you, but Brett Kavanaugh, who denied it, still got the job on the Supreme Court. And you write, Christine Blasey Ford, quote, "The strange part was that It didn't feel like I hadn't been heard. It felt like I had been believed, but then the response was a proverbial shrug.
I guess it was foreshadowed by my attorney saying the train is going where it's going. And they were right. It was going to go there no matter what I had said that day and no matter how compelling the testimony was.
You know, when I read the book, and I think when many other people read the book, you put yourself as a reader into, like, would I step away at this time? Would I go forward? What would I do, you know, as you go through that? And you describe, and you've been talking about the internal conflict you dealt with about coming forward, saying both that you regret it and that you would do it all over again, which on first blush sounds like two things in opposition. So help me understand that more. How do you hold both of those feelings at the same time?
Well, I would absolutely do it again. I still have the same sense of commitment to the United States and the same sense of civic duty. And so, of course, I would do it again. And I also realized the impact it had on other survivors. So if my one life was damaged in some way, that's one life. And it helped, if it helped so many people to be validated or heard, and that we heard from them in the letters, and they were in turn also validating me, then of course I don't regret it.
Let's talk about those letters. There are 100,000 of them, personal messages, handwritten, that you've gotten since you testified. There's this photo of, in the book, of you surrounded by these tens of thousands of handwritten letters. You categorize them, haven't you?
Yes, I've sorted them by country, by gender, by assault survivor, Me Too stories versus patriotic citizen letters. So 24% of the letters were from survivors who detailed their own experiences with assault.
What does those letters mean to you?
Everything. Everything. They are how I got through and how my family got through the ordeal, was this incredible outpouring of support from all over the country and all over the world.
And so beyond you and your family, as you say, they offer great personal support and helped you all get through. But what does that also tell you about where we're at with the reckoning around sexual assault and abuse today?
Well, I think we've made a lot of progress and we have a long way to go. So it's a lot more to be done at the structural level. And I think that we need to make it safer for survivors to come forward and help those that are trying to come forward. And one way we could do that is to try to establish protections where people can't retaliate against. The government should not be able to retaliate against people trying to help them.
And in the opening of your book, as you mentioned the letters, you say this is for all the letter writers.
Absolutely. So huge thank you. I wish I could write to them individually. And I started and tried to. And I wrote back to all the people who are over 90 years of age. And that took me so long. And I thought, even if I spend every day doing this, I won't necessarily be able to get to everyone. So this is my first thank you to them. And hopefully there'll be other ways that I can thank them as well.
More than 30 years ago, lawyer Anita Hill stood before the Senate Judiciary Committee giving her own testimony about an alleged sexual assault by Supreme Court Justice nominee Clarence Thomas, who of course sits on the bench. People have drawn so many similarities between your experiences, and you talk about her in the book as well. Whether it's in a hall of power or a workplace hallway, what do you want people to take away from your story as we collectively and individually continue to navigate these issues?
Well, I think people need to remember that whether they're on my side or not, that's okay, but they can't turn away from the fact that one in three women are sexually assaulted, and there's no sign of that epidemic abating, and we need to address that. Also, to your point about Dr. Hill, about Anita, I don't know that I ever would have come forward if it wasn't for her. Because it was so automatic in my mind that I needed to say something. And then when I reflect back, why would it be so automatic? It's because I saw someone else do that. So of course, that's what you're supposed to do if someone else has already paved that pathway and set that example, and you have similar information. So that was extremely inspiring for me.
My first question was to you was to tell me about Chrissy as you were known, and you went by your name Blasey, and then officially you had to become Christine Blasey Ford, which is how we all came to know you. And I asked you about that image that we all know of that woman in a Navy suit on that day in 2018. I'm wondering how you see that woman now.
Well, I'm proud of what I did, and I certainly paid a cost, and it was really difficult, and I continue to pay a little bit for it, and I'm willing to pay for it. Our wrangling with these kinds of situations, it is survivable, and you can rebuild your life, and in some ways, rebuilding your life is a bit of a gift, and I wish a lot of people could have that gift without all the crisis that makes that happen, but it is quite a gift to be able to rebuild your life with intention.
I so appreciate you talking to me. I know it's difficult. And as you say, no matter where people stand on issues and how they view you, that coming forward takes a lot of courage. Thank you.
Thank you.
Christine Blasey Ford's new memoir is called One Way Back. You can read more about this story by going to our website, cbc.ca/Sunday. You can find all the stories we bring you each week on the Sunday Magazine over on our website, cbc.ca/Sunday. I'm Pia Chattopadhyay. Thank you for lending us your ear, and we'll talk to you again on Sunday.
For more CBC podcasts, go to cbc.ca/podcasts.